Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It is Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And Rod Pyle is going to join us, our space guy, to talk about the Blood Moon and much more. All right here on 720 WGN. We're also going to rank the Star Trek movies, all of them. Right after we talk space with Rod. Our phone number is 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200 for talk and text. And it is Monday, so that means it's time for the Monday morning movie reviews. Jim Laskowski and Eric Childress join me each week to talk about the new movies. And let's jump right into that. We'll review all the new ones here. And here's Eric. Hey, Eric.
Hello.
All right. And Jim. Welcome back, Jim.
Hey, man. It's nice to be back. Hope you're keeping warm out there.
Yeah, it's pretty chilly out there, man.
Indeed.
Yeah. So not a ton of movies to talk about this week. Only one really big one opened up. And then we'll do the box office as well. Eric, when do you leave for Sundance?
Thursday. Thursday.
Okay, this coming Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And we'll get a couple of reports from you, right, from Sundance?
Yeah.
Okay,
yep.
Cool. What are you looking forward to?
Oh, boy. There's a new film from the director of The Overnight, Patrick Bryce. It's called Corporate Animals with Ed Helms and Demi Moore. It's kind of like a weekend retreat that goes wrong in a cave or some weird thing like that. That looks like it could be a lot of fun. There's a new an adaptation of Native Son, the book Native Son, that's set here in Chicago, that I'm going to be seeing on opening night. I'm looking forward to that. There's also a new documentary about the making of Alien.
Oh, no,
that's
going to
be premiering there.
Wow.
Yeah, from the director, the documentary filmmaker who did The People versus George Lucas.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, it's called Memory, the Origins of Alien.
Wow. Now, what do we know about that? I mean, did he get everybody? Is, like, Ridley Scott involved and...
That I don't know. I honestly don't know. It was one of the first things that was announced. I know people that are handling it, and I know it like goes all the way back to like you know the Dan O'Bannon days, and exactly. So I'm sure Dark Star is probably going to show up in there. I imagine.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping. You know, I hope it's pretty comprehensive. I mean, that guy has done some good work.
Yeah.
Alexandrio Felipe is his name. So. Really looking forward to that. That's going to be opening night as well.
All right, very cool. That's a great topic for a documentary.
Most certainly.
I mean, you know, it's such a legendary movie, and you know, So, well, that sounds cool. All right, so Sundance, you'll be leaving on Thursday to go to Sundance, So there we go. Let's get started.
Mm-hmm.
Jim, why don't you tell us about Cold War?
Oh, great. Okay. Yeah, this is the newest film from a very fascinating Polish director named Paweł Pawlikowski, I believe. And this is the official submission from Poland to the Academy Awards this year for Best Foreign Language Film, and it's won a lot of acclaim. So we follow a man named Victor, played by Thomas Kott, I believe. And he's in charge of sort of maintaining and directing this flourishing music company. And he's recruited to audition and select a troupe of singers and dancers to perform in a series of various stage shows. And in walks the luminous Joanna Kulig as Zula, who is one of the... singers and dancers who comes to audition, and I believe this takes place in Poland in about the late 40s, if I'm not mistaken, but it sort of jumps forward and backwards in time as well. So whomever is selected for this music company will go through kind of a lot of rigorous rehearsal and train intensively in this old chateau. Meanwhile, of course, war continues to break out, and both Victor and Zula become closer than close, and, you know, despite the surrounding difficulties of the culture and environment around them, they develop a very intense relationship, and we witness their affair as it jumps kind of forward several years with, you know, sort of experiencing their different feelings at different times, and just seeing how they survive and thrive during a lot of war-torn country falling apart. And, you know, it focuses also on a lot of live performance. And by the mid-1950s, this troupe sort of becomes internationally famous and invited to perform in the Soviet Union. And on a trip to Berlin, Victor sort of plans their escape so they can sort of just be together and not have to worry about all the things going on around them. But, of course, things happen to intervene, and the two of them essentially may or may not end up together, sort of as doomed partners, akin to kind of Bogart and Bacall. But this film definitely seems to echo and emulate Casablanca in a lot of ways, but at the same time, it's a very simple story, a very simple love story that's sort of just really enveloping due to its style. This director really trusts the audience to sort of fill in the gaps because, you know, the story here is told in this really understated, beautiful way. It's kind of this old-fashioned romance between two very different people. But it's also apparently very representative of what the director knew regarding his own parents and what they went through to various degrees. But this is a very lush and striking film, from the performances to this sort of 4:3 aspect ratio and breathtaking black and white cinematography. And the use of music in here is just pretty remarkable, whether it's sung or classical music or even pop hits. There's a really great moment involving Rock Around the Clock that sort of stands out. And it also breezes by in about 88 minutes. But I mean, for me, I think this is a pretty special film. I mean, the ending is a little abrupt, but I found myself really engrossed by it. It's not like a movie that I think will be coming out later this year called Transit that also sort of takes place during a tumultuous time in Europe and involves two very different people sort of experiencing love in the face of circumstances, very difficult circumstances in war. So I'm a huge fan of this director. The last film he made was called Ida, and he did a really good film early in his career with Emily Blunt called My Summer of Love. He's just really good at telling simple love stories, but in really interesting ways that are just kind of awe-inspiring at times with how he, you know, how he visually tells a story. There are definite cultural and socio-political tensions that sort of expand here, obviously, due to the time and, of course, the title of the film itself. So, yeah, I mean, for me, I just think this is one of the more interesting relationship studies, and it was actually number 18 on my list of favorite films for last year. So I absolutely recommend people checking it out if they can, especially on the big screen, because it's a gorgeous film.
Okay, that's Cold War. It's playing at the River East down here and at the Century in Evanston. So those two theaters are showing Cold War. Jim, you mentioned your favorite films of the year. You want to run down your list real quick, your top 10?
Oh, that's right. Yeah, no problem. For me, I always have a choice for number one, but I'm going to go through them here. And number 10 was Shoplifters. Number 9, The Writer. Number 8, of course, is Alfonso Cuarón's Roma, which, of course, everybody loves, and as well they should. Number 7 is Minding the Gap. Number 6 is Madeline's Madeline, a very interesting independent feature that is very challenging, and I wish people would seek that one out more. Number 5 is The Favorite. Number 4 is Hereditary. Number 3 is If Beale Street Could Talk. Number 2 is Blindspotting. And for me, number 1 is a film I actually got to review on your show here, is Burning, a movie that really snuck up on me more and more the more I thought about it. I just thought it was a remarkable film from this from South Korea.
All right, well, there you go. We also have a we had our list. We did our list a couple of weeks ago, and all three of us, Eric and Colin and I, all chose Roma as our best film. And that was the first time that's happened, Eric, since
Fury Road,
when all three of us have had the same movie at number one. So, next week, Jim, it's just going to be me and you because Eric's going to be in Sundance. We'll get a report from Eric, but we'll handle the reviews. There's not a ton of movies to review next week either, but I know that you're going to come up with a list of, like, underrated 80s movies for next week.
Yeah, it's interesting, too, because every year now, Eric, Colin, and I, we do this podcast where we sort of do a retrospective and we go back 30 years. So this year, obviously, we're covering 1989, and we're going to talk about all the movies that came out that year. And I just recently rewatched Johnny Handsome, and it made me start thinking about there are a lot of really great underrated 80s movies, and I was going to put together a quick list for us to talk about. I think that'll be a lot of fun.
Yeah, we'll do that. I can't believe Johnny Handsome's 30 years old. It's crazy.
Yeah, crazy.
I mean, Do the Right Thing is 30 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Man, that's wild.
Jeez.
Well, we'll talk about that next week when we can feel nice and old.
Sure.
All right, a couple more movies to review here, and Eric, you and I will go over the box office as well. So,
yeah.
Guys, hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, Eric Childress and Jim Leskowski reviewing the new movies with me, and Eric is going off to Sundance on Thursday, and we'll get some reports from there from him. Okay, a couple more movies to review, but we got a break here for the news right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here on a Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We got a Blackhawks Express, a fun Blackhawks Express to play back from yesterday's game. We are also going to be talking about Star Trek movies. Our good friend Rod Pyle is going to join us to talk about the Blood Moon and more space-related issues. And also we'll tell you how you can celebrate MLK Day today. So all that coming up and more. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. It is Monday, and that means that the movie reviews happen every Monday morning. Jim Leskowski and Eric Childress join me to review the new movies. Here's Eric. Hello, Eric.
Hello.
And Jim, welcome back.
Hi there.
All right. Eric, tell us about The Standoff at Sparrow Creek.
Okay, this is a film that I saw back at the Toronto Film Festival last September. I don't remember if we talked about this one or not, but it's a directorial debut of a guy named Henry Dunham, I believe is his.
Yeah.
Dunham. And it's the story of the beginning of the movie, a police funeral has been terrorized by someone as part of a local militia. They have shot up the place. They have killed a number of police officers, and the cops are now on the lookout for who this person was. Well, as the movie also opens, we get to meet the members of the local militia who are all gathering at their compound, basically, to figure out exactly if one of their members is the person responsible for shooting this up. Obviously, this is of great concern to them. Not so much that they don't agree with what they've done, but the fact that, you know, doing something like this puts them at complete risk. And, you know, cops won't just be after the one guy, they'll be after the entire crew. One of the members is played by James Badge Dale, who also happens to be an ex-cop. And as everyone gathers there, they discover that a gun is indeed missing. He is basically put in charge of interrogating everyone and trying to figure out exactly if he can break down if one of these guys is responsible for it. Also part of the crew, Brian Garrity, who plays, I don't want to tell you too much about who he plays. He's just a member of the militia. The leader of the militia, and this is to me just great casting, Chris Mulkey, who is a character actor that has been around since the 1980s, maybe even earlier than that.
He's been around forever. Mulkey.
Yeah. Seriously. Yeah. He was like in every, you know, I probably guarantee that, you know, when Jim brings up one of these underrated 80s movies next week, Chris Mulkey's probably in it.
Yeah.
And he plays the leader of the militia. And it's, you know, so you have a kind of a Reservoir Dogs-like scenario. And if, you know, another potential Tarantino ripoff sounds like something that you might not be that interested in, let me, you know, persuade you otherwise, because this is actually one of the better, you know, films in that respect. It, you know, it certainly has, you know, Reservoir Dogs tendencies throughout, you know, exactly who is the mole, or, you know, in this case, who is the killer amongst them, if there is, even is one. But the dialogue in the film, while Tarantino certainly has his own style, the dialogue in the film is actually a lot more in tune with David Mamet. And there's the interrogation scenes with Badge Dale are particularly striking. James Badge Dale, who I think he had like 3 or 4 films at Toronto last year, including the Jeremy Saulnier new film Hold the Dark on Netflix. And I think he's the best thing in that. This guy is someone that I want to see more and more of, because he's got a great presence. He holds the screen so well. He's terrific in this movie. And, you know, and ultimately, you know, while you're trying to figure out, you know, exactly, you know, who the bad guy is, even though they're all basically bad guys, there's something really satiric going on about, you know, things that are going on in this country, but about basically idiots who will believe anything. And that really sort of kind of slyly rears its head throughout this movie. And it's a real sort of important underlying statement that's going on throughout this film. While at the meantime, giving you like a really terrific mystery, a procedural, again, great dialogue, and James Badge Dale giving a performance that you're going to go, I want to see more of that guy. So the film is playing in like 1 or 2 theaters here in the Chicagoland area, but it's also available on VOD, I believe.
Yes, it is.
So you're going to want to check this one out, The Standoff at Sparrow Creek.
Standoff at Sparrow Creek. All right. Jim, what'd you think?
Oh, man. I dug this a lot. I've sort of been describing it to some people as, you know, Eric mentioned Reservoir Dogs. I also thought a little bit of The Thing and, you know, the work of Jeremy Saulnier and a little touch of Mamet here. So, I mean, this is totally up my alley. I love this type of sort of straightforward plot that manages to, again, much like Cold War, do a whole lot with its setup and characters, even if, you know, maybe how it all starts out and how it's set up, you know, kind of seems familiar, again, in that Reservoir Dogs sense, but the way things play out and the way these characters interact is consistently compelling. It's just this really interesting examination of doubt and uncertainty and dealing with fear among, you know, a group of men that, you know, have a tendency to react very violently at times, or at least get really intense with their emotions, and it has very little score, but just like a lot of tension and really great dialogue and memorable confrontations, and every single character here is very distinctive. And Eric's right in that I want to, you know, see more with this with James Badge Dale, and you know you'll definitely recognize several of these character actors, including Chris Mulkey, and you know, it's just a really strong film that flies by. Again, it's another movie that's, you know, under 90 minutes, and you'll enjoy pretty much every interaction, and you'll also want to just know how things play out. You'll want to, you know, sort of piece together along with these characters on the screen this mystery. But yeah, I mean, this is how you do suspense and characterization in a way that brings you in and brings you closer. Unlike a certain other director we'll be getting to very shortly, I highly, highly recommend people seek this out at VOD. This is a really startlingly good debut film with some excellent character work by everyone here. So check it out, please.
All right. So that's The Standoff at Sparrow Creek. Eric, what do we know about this filmmaker? It's his first script, his first film.
Yeah, that basically it. Yeah, I mean, that's all I'm aware of. First thing he's cracked. I think he's made some short films prior to this, but Yeah, this was, you know, this is actually the first movie I saw Toronto last year. I actually got an advanced screener of it. And, you know, sometimes you get movies like that and, you know, it might seem like it might be getting thrown away. And this one absolutely wasn't. I mean, this was one of the real discoveries from Toronto last year. And I wish it wasn't coming out in January in the midst where it's going to get buried. I talked about a film called Small Town Crime on our Best Of show.
Yeah.
And that was another film that a great detective story with John Hawks that just got buried in January. I don't even know if they even got a VOD release back then. That Standoff, I think, is at least getting that much. But don't let this one pass you by, because in the midst of a lot of really bad VOD films that's out there, this is really one of the standout ones.
Okay, that's The Standoff at Sparrow Creek. All right. Now, I wasn't even aware that there was what is this Dragon Ball Super Broly? What does that even mean?
Jim? I don't know anything about this world at all.
It's anime, it's Dragon Ball. We had a live action Dragon Ball film, Dragon Ball Evolution, a few years ago.
Yeah.
But this is purely an anime film. So I don't know. I honestly can't tell you anything about them. I've never seen a Dragon Ball film. I don't know. You know, it's just Pokemon for anime adults, I guess. I have no idea what these films and what the storyline is about.
Goku and Vegeta encounter Broly, a Saiyan warrior unlike any fighter they've faced before. There you go.
I'm surprised you didn't go see this, Nick. You went and saw that Pokemon movie, I remember.
Well, that was years ago. that completely freaked me out. I didn't know what the hell was going on when I was watching that thing. It made money over the weekend.
It did very well.
I mean, what are we talking? We'll talk about it later. But wow, apparently there are.
Yeah, no, this is the story of the week, as far as I'm concerned.
Uh huh. Is this the...
Yeah, it's just, I mean, it's the company that put it out is called Funimation, and they've been getting into the theatrical game a little bit more. I mean, they are kind of one of the premier home video market for all kinds of anime titles. But in the theatrical market, I mean, they put out the film Your Name last year, which was a pretty decent hit. They put out a lot of these Dragon Ball films and whatnot. And a lot of them, you know, just kind of like one week or one night even events, Fathom events. They've done a lot of these things.
Yeah.
But this was an actual release. And when I saw like the first day numbers for this thing came in, I was like, whoa.
Yeah.
Pretty impressive.
It is pretty impressive, the amount of money it made. We'll get to that. We'll get to that a little bit later on when we talk box office. So interesting. Dragon Ball Super Broly.
Yeah.
Still have no idea what the hell the title means, but there you go. All right, guys, hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, Eric Childress and Jim Laskowski are here. And when we come back, we get to review the new M. Night Shyamalan movie. So we will return right after this on 720 WGN. Hey, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m., my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because that's what we do on Monday morning. And coming up at 5 o'clock, Steve Grzanich with the opening bell. And also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. So there you go. All right. One more movie to talk about. Jim Laskowski and Eric Childress join me every Monday morning to talk movies. And let's welcome them back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Jim, welcome back.
Thank you much.
All right, Jim, tell us about Glass.
Okay, this is the latest from M. Night Shyamalan, who previously gave us, of course, and he had his breakthrough with The Sixth Sense, then followed that one up with the first in a trilogy of a superhero saga, though didn't really know it was going to be a trilogy at the time. Unbreakable, that is, came out 19 years ago. Whereas his last film, Split, was only a couple years ago, and it turns out that was the second chapter of his three-part saga, and Glass is supposedly the third and final chapter as we follow these characters in the current state after the events of their respective films. We first find security expert David Dunn, played by Bruce Willis, on the hunt for the elusive and mysterious Kevin, played by James McAvoy, who battles multiple personality disorder, as we saw in Split. And it seems that he was never captured. So, of course, David, being the superhero of the film, has managed to track him down with the help of his now adult son. So we start off with a very intense, heated confrontation between hero and villain in an abandoned warehouse. But then both David and Kevin are captured by the authorities, only to be placed in the same institution as Elijah Price, a.k.a. Mr. Glass, played once again here by Samuel Jackson. It turns out that a psychiatrist named Dr. Staple, played by Sarah Paulson, has been recruited to help the three of them and convince each of them that they are actually not superheroes with amazing powers or any gifts. Though, of course, we, the audience, have already seen the evidence that they do possess special powers in the previous films. So we spend a good chunk of time engaged in dialogue and like a support group of sorts surrounding these three individuals as they begin to question their identity. And Dr. Staple also wants to conduct an experimental procedure to help Mr. Glass's brain become more malleable, we'll say. But Mr. Glass has other plans, particularly for Kevin, who's one of many personalities is known as the Beast, who can crush dudes with a single embrace and sort of leap around like a cheetah, possessing incredible strength and agility. So Mr. Glass decides it's time to break free along with Kevin, while the unbreakable David also may end up playing a significant role in how all of this plays out, with sort of a final act showdown that takes place before the eyes of many, including Glass's mother, David's son, and Casey also returns here, played by Anya Taylor-Joy, who successfully stopped the Beast in Split and kind of has the power to keep Kevin out of trouble. So obviously something interesting must play out with these very different three characters, particularly during the final stretch, as we would hope, since this is essentially the conclusion of M. Night's story, and he usually has tricks up his sleeve. Whether they're successful or not, that's kind of always up for debate. So, for me, I don't know. I'm not completely down on M. Night to the same degree that you two have been in the past. I think it's just a matter of appreciating certain elements or performances or scores or cinematography. I think the majority of his filmography is unsuccessful, especially when it comes down to the third acts. I just think where he tends to fail fundamentally really is with the scripts. There's just really a lot of eye-rolling dialogue in the majority of his films, ridiculous character choices that don't seem to fit, and just a lot of odd decisions. And I think a lot of that is sort of captured and summarized in one of the worst films I've ever seen, which to me was The Happening. And, you know, that being said, though, I was very surprised by Split. I actually quite liked it. I mean, it has, you know, your expected scenery chewing performance at the center, but I also really liked the message at the end of the film about shared trauma and sort of feeling connected to someone who's been through a lot and finding comfort in it. It was a nice message to end that film on, and I actually walked out feeling like, I think I really liked an M. Night movie for once. But then, of course, that final moment that sort of let us know that, hey, this is essentially a sequel to Unbreakable, but definitely made my eyes roll. So now with Glass, I got to say, it did very little for me. We spend such a long stretch of this film kind of imprisoned inside his really, really lazy, lackluster writing and the hammering of the superhero themes and mythology that's always spoken front and center in this sort of like really insulting, pandering degree most of the time. It really feels more like fan fiction from its own creator rather than anything that sort of functions and and flows organically. And it's really a dull film. I mean, I think both Bruce Willis and Samuel Jackson kind of sleepwalk through their performances and bring very little here. I mean, Sarah Paulson and McAvoy do their best with very little, and of course, without giving anything away. I just think the layering of twists in the third act is, again, eye-rolling and simplistic and silly. I just think M. Night often thinks he's being really profound and enlightening when it's actually really uninteresting and not deep in any way, shape, or form. So, I mean, I think he thinks there's a lot to be said here about, you know, belief and self-empowerment or whatever, but none of it really rings true or just sticks the landing, especially as things play out. So as much as I did like Split and kind of liked Unbreakable, I got to say that Glass is M. Night at his laziest and displaying everything that I kind of find bad about his work. So this is really a boring, empty experience that I cannot recommend to anyone.
All right. All right, guys, hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, Eric Childress and Jim Liskowski here. We are reviewing Glass, M. Night Shyamalan's follow-up to Unbreakable and Split. And we'll get Eric's thoughts and my thoughts and box office, too, as we continue. We'll take a break right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. The great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. And we've got my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. We're going to talk with Rod Pyle, our space guy, about the Blood Moon and much, much more. We're also going to talk Star Trek movies and then tell you how you can celebrate MLK Day. So all of that and more. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text, 312-981-7200. We're in the middle of the movie reviews here before the break. Jim Liskowski told us about Glass. And he is not recommending it. And let's get the guys back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Jim, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, Eric. what did you think of Glass?
Oh, Nick. You and I have been talking movies for 20 years now.
Yep.
On your show.
Yep.
And in that time, M. Night Shyamalan has never made a good movie. In my opinion.
Yeah.
So people who want to listen to this review with a grain of salt and a drink of water, that's their business.
Let me just say this before you get into it. I never liked a movie of his until Split.
I know. But you don't like the movie as much as you like McAvoy.
Right. No, exactly. And I hate the last scene. I mean, I just the last scene of Split, I just went, you got to be kidding me, right?
Right.
I mean, the reason why I like Split is simply because of McAvoy. I think McAvoy's good in this too. He's one of my favorite actors on the planet, and I really thought he tore it up. He tore it up in Split. So that's the reason why.
Well, McAvoy shows up to work.
Yes, he does.
And he showed up in Split, and he shows up in Glass,
yes,
which is more than I can say for Bruce Willis. Which I'll get to in a second.
Yeah.
I am just, watching, Jim was, describing a lot of the twists and turns in this movie as silly and, pedantic and whatever. I find them rather insulting. And the reason being because, M. Night has his fans. I don't dispute that. I know there's Team Villages out there, okay? I know they exist.
Yeah.
Okay? And so, granted, and most everyone seems to agree that Unbreakable may just be his best movie. Okay, so I will grant them that. It's the least bad of... that and Signs, I think, are the least bad of his movies. So the prospect of someone who is really a fan of Unbreakable might react differently to that final scene in Split. And if I cared, I would think that was really cool.
Yeah.
Like, oh man, we're finally, this is finally happening. Okay, no pun intended.
Yeah.
And so here comes Glass, and he's going to complete this trilogy that he said he was going to give the fans back in 2000, and here we're going to wrap this whole thing up. And the entire exercise to me, and I do mean exercise because this is not a film, the entire exercise to me feels like someone you encounter on Twitter okay, or someone in a coffee shop who tells you you are a moron for liking comic books. You are an absolute moron. You have wasted your life liking comic books. Okay, but I got this really cool idea for a comic book. You should listen to what I got to say. Okay? And when he lays out the climax of the film, which I'm obviously not going to give away.
Yeah.
But when he lays out his first, the first of which is his signature twist to the thing. If I was deeply invested in this world, I would want to strangle him for what he does in the third act of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be like, you have got to be kidding me. Okay? And then he follows it up with a denouement that is just idiotic. Because in 2000, when Unbreakable came out and he was starting to create this world, the world had not even gotten Sam Raimi's Spider-Man yet.
Right.
We were not on the precipice of the Marvel Cinematic Universe or even the DC Universe.
Right.
Okay? But now, 19 years later, we are neck deep in all of this stuff. Comic book films are the thing. Except the world that he continues to inhabit is a world where there's no comic book movies, apparently. You couldn't even think to mention any of those. The only thing that exists is the Batman TV show, apparently. And comic book places are apparently like speakeasies. Every comic book shop that they frequent in the film is like some backdoor place. And, you know, Anya Taylor-Joy goes in there and there's like, oh my God, a girl comes in here. You know, it's that level of insult to people who are true comic book fans, people who look upon the stuff as art, okay? Yes, we've been inundated with comic book films, and yes, we wish that there was a lot more out there, but there are some really good ones. And watching him, you know, go through the motions and lay out, trying to, you know, hypnotize us in a way, or beating us over the head and telling us, you're wrong for liking these movies, the way that Sarah Paulson does, and what I think is the worst scene in the entire film, this extended therapy session where she tries to reason with them and say, like, well, maybe if, you know, what really happened is you did this. It's some of the worst writing M. Night has ever done, frankly.
Yeah.
And it upset me even more because I don't think Sarah Paulson has ever been worse in anything she's ever done. She looks I know that part of that's ingrained in the character and what that character is, but she looks confused. She looks like she's like a hostage as she looks at the screen. She's actually it looks like she's looking at the audience going, help me get out of this. I am being held here against my will, saying these ridiculous lines. That is like the opposite of the end of Contact, where they try to convince Jodie Foster that everything that she has seen is not what she has really seen.
Right.
It is awful in so many ways, insulting in ways that, and I'm not even a comic book reader myself, but I felt insulted. I felt insulted on behalf of all of his fans. I'm like, how could you do that to the people who still support you? You know, I'm like, screw you, frankly. On behalf of the people who have supported you through Lady in the Water and The Happening and After Earth and, like, oh, you're not that bad, you know, shame on you. M. Night Shyamalan, shame on you.
Yeah. This is terrible. I mean, this is really terrible. I happen to like Split and until the final scene, and then I was like, oh, come on. And then this whole, I mean, I didn't like Unbreakable. I know a lot of people maintain that that's probably his best movie, and I know a lot of people like that movie. They really do. And the thing is that you're absolutely right about this being insulting, Eric, completely. Because the people that like Unbreakable are comic book fans. They're, you know what I mean? They're genuine,
yeah,
comic book fans. Everybody I know who likes Unbreakable is a comic book fan. And you're absolutely right. I mean, it's an insult to the people who liked Unbreakable. You know, and I know that a lot of fans of Unbreakable were very excited At the last scene of Split. You know what I mean? People were like, oh, awesome. You know, they were very, because I know a lot of people who like Unbreakable, and they were very excited that final scene. But man, this is just, I mean, this is as bad as it gets. It's one of the worst movies he's ever made, and he's made a lot of terrible movies, and it's long, and it's boring. And why did Bruce Willis even show up? You want to talk about sleepwalking through a role. You know what I mean? It was just the laziest acting I've ever seen. And Samuel Jackson's just doing the Samuel L. Jackson thing, and he doesn't seem very invested in it. The only person who showed up to play again is McAvoy, and the script is ridiculous, but he does, what he can. You can tell he's having a lot of fun doing all these, different characters and all that stuff. So he's fun to watch. Bringing back some of the characters from Unbreakable doesn't make any sense, and especially doesn't make any sense to bring Anya Taylor-Joy back to this movie. That just seems completely
unnecessary. Also seemed further insulting the way that they were trying to make you sympathize with the McAvoy character who mutilates young girls. Let's not beat around the bush.
Yeah.
He mutilates young girls, and they're trying to do this whole Beauty and the Beast thing with him.
Right.
Which, I mean, you know, they actually calls him the Beast, and they're trying to do Beauty and the Beast. You're really on top of it, Knight.
Yeah. There's nothing exciting about this. The only thing that's kind of fun to watch is McAvoy, because he's so good. But, man, this is as base and stupid as it gets, and with a really insulting message, you're right. But the overall thing is, though, guys, this movie's boring. It's just really boring. Like nothing. There are stretches where nothing happens, and you're like, "What are we doing here?" I mean, it's
not
like,
to mention that your title character doesn't speak for 66 minutes,
right?
Okay, your title character doesn't speak for 66 minutes, and again, like I know that you can't help but sometimes in the trailer, but the guy's either doped up or he's not for 66 minutes.
Right.
What do you think the answer is?
Yeah. And it's
not the twist.
It's 2 hours and 10 minutes long, too. So it's not a short, it's not a short movie by any stretch of the imagination. And it feels like 2 hours and 10 minutes. And Bruce Willis, I mean, it's the laziest. I mean, I'm glad the check clears. You know what I mean? I mean, my God.
Yeah.
It's like he just doesn't even want to be there. When was the last time Bruce Willis actually gave a good performance?
I mean, Sin City?
Sin City, yeah, I guess Sin City. That would be...
I'm taking a stab at it because he's done a lot of direct-to-video work.
Yeah, he has.
Over the years, and wow, is he sleepwalking. I mean, he was sleepwalking through his own roast, for God's sake.
It's true. I mean, like, he just doesn't care. You know what I mean? And when you're watching this movie, it's like, dude, at least, put some energy into it. I mean, at least. I mean, don't make it so obvious that you clearly don't want to be there. And yes, Eric, Sarah Paulson is so bad in this movie, and she's one of my favorite actresses on the planet.
I know.
And she's saddled with some of the most ridiculous dialogue, and that scene that you're talking about, that extended scene, this therapy thing, is just as ridiculous as you could possibly imagine. And she is, yes, you're right. I mean, she's stuck looking directly into the lens of the camera and having to say some of the stupidest dialogue that any actress could ever possibly imagine.
And also, as she walks through this giant mental institution, okay, this giant thing that apparently only employs two orderlies.
Yeah.
By the way.
Yeah.
Every time she goes into one of their rooms, she explains everything that's going on in the hospital.
Yeah.
So in case they have any ideas about how to escape or what they need to do, she lays it all out for them in exposition. They're like, wait, why are you telling the patients this?
Yeah. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
It is absolutely ridiculous. And hey, here's a question. I mean, I've only seen Split the one time. You know, I saw it when it came out a couple of years ago. Did Betty Buckley get killed in that movie?
Was she the psychiatrist?
Yeah. She does. Because I was going to say,
I believe so. Yeah.
Because I don't remember, and I was like, well, why don't they have her back? You know what I mean?
Yeah. No. She died. Yeah. Patricia or someone killed her.
Somebody kills her. Right.
One of his personalities kills her.
Okay, all right. So she does end up getting killed. Because that was when I was watching this movie. I'm like, I don't remember because I, the only thing that the only thing that stayed with me after I saw Split was McAvoy. I don't remember anything. I don't really remember anything else about the movie. I just didn't remember whether Betty Buckley died or not. But apparently she did because otherwise they would have and should have brought her back.
Right.
So anyway,
And Robin Wright said no, thank you.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It's a really, really terrible movie. It's worse than I thought it was going to be, and I thought it was going to be awful. And you remember that time where it was embarrassing to have M. Night Shyamalan's name on stuff, and he wasn't putting his name above the titles or anything? Remember those days?
Yeah, I remember. Yeah, the Devil trailer.
Yeah, I miss those days.
Yeah, although I think they're going to come back with a vengeance.
Yeah,
Nick.
You think so?
I think that this is the movie where where everyone turns on him again.
Yeah. I really do.
I think this is his next village moment.
Yeah, and I will tell you this. You know, judging from, you know, social media and my Facebook page and stuff like that, people hate this movie. People are hating it. We're not the only three. You know what I mean? Like,
nope.
The
fans are hating it.
Yeah, the fans are hating it. Like, the Unbreakable fans are hating it. So, all right.
They totally should. And I've given him a pass here and there in the past, but. This is like up there with The Happening in terms of how bad it is.
Yeah, we'll talk about the box office, and we'll see how much it drops. There's no competition for it next week, right? Oh, well, wait.
No competition over the next 2 weeks.
Yeah, I'm actually looking forward to The Kid Who Would Be King, but that's not the same audience. You know what I mean?
No, so absolutely not.
But I'm actually looking forward to that movie. I think that movie looks really, really fun. And it's the guy who directed Attack of the Block.
Right, so, first movie since then, and what I hear, a lot of good things.
Yeah, no, it looks terrific. It's a great. I mean, listen. First of all, you got you got Patrick Stewart, right? It's Patrick Stewart, right? Is in it. He plays.
Is he in it?
One of those guys.
Yeah, no, he's in it.
Yeah, it's Patrick Stewart. He plays Merlin. He plays like the older version of Merlin who disguises himself as a teenager. And you got Patrick Stewart with a Zeppelin shirt on. So I'm like, okay. Patrick Stewart's wearing a Led Zeppelin shirt. I'm all over this.
So, uh-huh.
But what about Serenity? Now, this is a movie with Anne Hathaway and Matthew McConaughey that they're just, it seems like, is this a movie that's been on the schedule for a long time? It seems like it's being dumped.
Yeah, it was supposed to come out last October, and they just pushed it into January. I don't think that they know how to market the film. Because you look at the trailer, it's like some people describe it as like a film noir kind of thing. It looks like, you know, like this year's Palmetto, but other people, just the title of it suggests that, you know, it might be something, you know, ethereal or something, that it's, you know, one of those types of movies.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've seen the trailer for it, and Anne Hathaway has done the circuit promoting it, and it looks just like, hey, I want to hire you to kill somebody. I want you to throw my husband off of the boat. That's all I can figure out. So anyway, well, we'll
but
talk
it's,
about that.
It's written by Stephen Knight, and he did Dirty Pretty Things and wrote the script for Eastern Promises, but he also directed a really good Tom Hardy movie, Lock.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll find out next week. All right. Jim, thanks, buddy, and we'll talk to you next week.
Absolutely. It's always a blast, man. Talk to you then.
Okay, take care. There's Jim. He's going to – and Eric, you hang on, okay?
Yeah.
All right, Eric's going to hang on. When we come back, we're going to talk box office for the week right after this on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. Coming up after the 2:30 news, our good friend Rod Pyle is going to join us to talk all things space, and also he's got some great stuff about the crazy blood moon that's out there, and we'll talk about that and more. We're going to talk Star Trek movies, and my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, and much more. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text, 312-981-7200. Eric Childress is hanging out with me to talk box office, and let's get Eric back here. Hey, Eric.
Hey.
All right. So these are just the 3-day totals because they're doing, they're counting the 4-day total because today is a holiday. So
right.
But these are just for the weekend, just for the 3 days. Number one, Glass with $40.5 million, weren't people predicting over 50 for this?
Yeah. Yeah, I think this is a really low number.
Yeah,
actually, I mean it's big for January.
Yeah,
it's very big for January. But depending on what the movie does, I mean, I think everyone, including myself, had figured that this movie was going to have the second best Martin Luther King weekend ever. American Sniper being number one, and it should have been very easily. the second best, but there's a chance it might not beat the first Ride Along film.
Wow.
Which would be really kind of stunning, actually. And that leaves the door open to see exactly where this film is going to go from here. Like we had just kind of mentioned, there's not a lot of competition over the next couple of weeks. We've
right.
got The Man, Kid Who Would Be King and Serenity next week, and then the remake of Miss Bala comes out the week after that.
Right.
Which, and that's the only thing opening that week, so they're not expecting a lot of money out of that. Unless The Kid Who Would Be King find some kind of audience, I think that's the only thing that could take it down over the next couple of weeks until like the 8th when like the Lego Movie and a whole bunch of stuff opens on February 8th.
Yeah.
But I'm really very curious to see how the numbers go, like where the numbers drop from, because I mean, it's got to drop 50%
week. No, it's going to drop
so,
big, yeah.
Yeah, so this thing's got to be in the teens. Probably next weekend. Probably might still be number one. Again, unless Kid Who Would Be King. That'd be hilarious if Kid Who Would Be King beats it. That'd be wonderful.
It would.
That'd
it would be
fantastic.
Yeah.
And I'm really not gonna rule it out just yet. It'd be shocking if this thing didn't make $100 million. I mean, the Martin Luther King holiday is going to help that immensely.
Yeah.
But I think that you're going to look at probably something under 125.
That's amazing.
Which is less than what Split made.
Yeah.
And, but it's all kind of semantics because this film is already practically in profit already.
Yeah.
It only cost $20 million. Blumhouse, knows exactly how to rein Shyamalan in.
Right.
You know, they give him a big building, but you only have two orderlies.
Right.
$40 million this weekend on a $20 million budget. It's just about there.
Yeah. All right. Number two is The Upside, $15.6 million. Solid numbers.
The very solid numbers.
Yeah,
this is actually a real surprise hit.
Yeah.
This is a much as big a story as Glass, as far as I'm concerned, because this is looking like something that's going to exceed $70 million.
Yeah.
I mean, it had barely. I mean, I know the Sunday to Monday is a holiday, but it made $19.5 million last week and 15.6 this weekend.
Yeah.
That's an incredibly small drop.
Yeah.
So this thing is it's clearly playing well with adults, and like Glass, it's got 2 weeks of not a lot of competition.
Right.
The Serenity's not going to make dime one.
No, it's not.
And I don't think Miss Ball is going to do particularly well either.
Yeah. Number three, Dragon Ball Super Broly. We talked about that one already. A big success. Number four, Aquaman. It's over $300 million in America.
In the top 25 worldwide all time.
And then number five is Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. Big success for that one, man, because it was, again, another movie that came out of nowhere.
Yeah, holding very well, $160 million at this point. $200 million seems a little bit out of its reach,
right.
But animated Spider-Man doing this well, and is going to be, again, this is one of those movies that's going to linger and last for a while.
I agree. All right, Eric, have a safe trip, and we'll talk to you from Sundance, okay, buddy?
Sounds great. Thanks
very
much.
We'll have Eric back. He'll be live from Sundance with a couple of reports next week. He leaves on Thursday for the Sundance Film Festival, and he'll give us exclusive reports of some of the new movies that he's going to see while he's there. All right, we're going to take a break here on 720 WGN. The news is...